Welcome to episode 58 of the Golf Talk Podcast, brought to you by thesandtrap.com. This is Eric Barzeski in Pennsylvania. Joining me this week, Jeff and Jack. Jeff first in Washington. Hello.
Hello, sir.
And Jack in New Jersey again.
Hey, greetings.
Well, last week we celebrated Tiger Woods' 57th victory with our 57th podcast. This week, Tiger played again, but no 58th victory to go along with our 58th podcast. Instead, Phil Mickelson wins the Players' Championship in a fairly impressive performance, especially the last day. I think 10 of 14 fairways, the ones he did miss, weren't that bad, and 16 of 18 greens. So a good performance all around, really.
Yeah, very uncharacteristic Mickelson, but obviously, as everyone's talking about, some swing changes are maybe settling in, and it was a great win for him.
That was, I think Jeff just said it, an uncharacteristic performance. He was solid. He was solid, and nobody could catch him.
So two T3s and now a victory for Phil Mickelson in the 3 weeks since he's moved to Butch Harmon. How much credit can you give Butch in this change? I mean, it's really kind of a small change. It's you know, basically, don't try to kill the ball, Phil.
Well, you know, I think if some credit has to be given to Butch. I mean, even Phil said, you know, when asked the difference between Rick and Butch, he said, you know, Butch swears a lot more, and maybe the swing got through to him. You know, he's shortened up his swing. He's keeping his back leg flexed a little bit more, and as you pointed out to me, Eric, he's swinging much more level. And if Phil can hit fairways, I think he hit 80%+ of the greens in that tournament. And with his short game, he's tough to beat.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of credit has to go to Butch Harmon. I mean, a big part of it is that you have to be able to speak into a PGA Tour professional's ego. And obviously, Butch, he's pretty rough around the edges. He's able to just be himself. And I think he's spoken to Phil in a way that, you know, is getting through. And I think it is a significant change. I mean, when you shorten up a backswing as much as Phil has done, if any of us who've kind of tried to tweak with our swings a little bit, you know how big that change can feel. And so I think it's significant. As Phil was said, he's excited about what the future holds. And so I think that we're going to see perhaps a more consistent Phil if he can just be patient. And I think he likes winning enough that he's willing to listen.
One quick question, too, is how bad does Rick Smith feel right about now?
Pretty bad. He's feeling pretty bad, I think.
So, you know, all this talk, you know, Jeff and I were doing the podcast last year when we were talking about, is Phil the best player in the world now? And then, you know, Wingfoot happened, Tiger won two more majors, and we all kind of forgot about that. And it's funny, it's already happening again this year. Phil has struggled all year. He struggled since the U.S. Open, basically, last year. Put together a good week at Pebble Beach this year earlier to win. But now suddenly everyone's like, oh, it's going to be Tiger versus Phil at the U.S. Open. Again, it's almost silly how often this comes up because they need to force rivalry on Tiger, but is Phil the favorite now at Oakmont?
I think you have to separate reality from media hype. You know, we golf writers are always looking for an angle, always looking for a story. And the two most popular players in the world right now are Mickelson and Woods. So anything you can do to set up some sort of a duel, a showdown at the OK Corral between those two is good for your copy because you can keep that going forever. But in reality, Mickelson and Woods are two of Woods is the best player in the world, and Mickelson is certainly one of the best players in the world. Are they favorites for the Open? Okay, yeah, they are.
All right.
Well, it's a favorite of the week, and obviously Mickelson is the favorite of a lot of people's week this week because of his performance. But I think it wouldn't surprise me to see Phil go out there and play very well, especially with a substantial swing change like this. So.
All right. I wanted to give credit to Sean O'Hare. I think he played a little shaky, more shaky than I've seen written in the final round. Bad driving early on, funny iron shots in the middle of the round, and some loose putting towards the end. But I do want to give him credit for firing at the flag on 17 and going for the win, basically. He said, I'm not worried about the money. He cost himself $750,000 or something like that by falling from second to sixth or whatever he did.
11th.
So he cost himself a good bit of money. He said, I'm going to make plenty of money over my career. I'm trying to win. This is something we don't see. This is something we complain about, young Americans being content just to earn money and keep their tour cards and stuff. And so I really want to applaud him for that. Do you guys have any thoughts on that to add?
No, I thought it was great that he did fire at the pin, go for that green. I think that he had that 9-iron in mind that he thought he was over the green, but then hit the green, and it probably was just, well, it was obviously too much club. So whether he got missed club there or what happened, but, you know, I think it showed true poise, and I think a lot of people like Sean O'Hare. He's a solid player, and to see him say that kind of thing in the midst of kind of a positioning bunch of golfers, man, that was neat to see.
I agree completely. In an age where everybody is trying to make a check and 125th on the money list makes $600,000, there's a lot of money out there. And at 24, there's a lot of money in his future. And I think that the attitude to go for it and go for the win is, how refreshing is that in professional golf?
That's what I'm saying. I think he'll be a guy to look to for the next 10, 20 years. This week, we'll be right back with after this message with an interview with Steve Pelisek, the vice president of golf clubs for Titleist. So stay tuned for that.
I'm working on posting more red numbers.
I'm working on the fundamentals.
Firing right at the target.
Winning my first major.
Pulling out.
Winning in my hometown, Augusta, Georgia.
Being a winner and a mom.
Working on my pivot.
My short game.
Going lower.
I'm just working on sticking to my game plan.
Ball position and alignment.
What I'm going to wear tomorrow.
Nice shirt.
I'm just trying to get better every day.
Even the world's best want to be better. That's why there's the new Pro V1 and Pro V1X.
And welcome back. This week we're talking with Steve Pelisek, the vice president for Titleist and their golf club sales and marketing department. Hi, Steve.
Good morning.
Steve's here to tell us about the new Titleist drivers, the 907 D1 and the 907 D2. So why don't you begin by telling us about those clubs, what are the differences we can see in the trajectory, shot shape, and the target market for each of the drivers?
Sure. Well, there isn't much difference in the general target market for both drivers. I mean, we're staying consistent with our mission to make and market golf clubs for generally the better player. So I think both of these drivers will appeal to better players, but there is a primary difference in how the two products perform and how they look. And if you've noticed some of the advertising that we're running these days, I think that does a nice job describing both drivers. 907 D1 is a high MOI driver, which we think creates maximum distance while being very forgiving. 907 D2 we're calling an enhanced MOI driver, which we think creates maximum distance but retains workability. And the two drivers are different in appearance, obviously, and that has to do with the basic objective of designing one to be high MOI and one to be enhanced MOI. I really think in practical purposes, the primary difference in how the two drivers perform is in the shot shapes they create. They're both maximum ball speed drivers, they're both high launch drivers, and they're both relatively low spin drivers. But they do create very distinctly different shot shapes, and that stems from the MOI factors. D1, being a high MOI driver, is generally less workable. It hits straight balls. D2, being more of an enhanced MOI driver, is much more workable. And generally, you know, if you like to work the ball right to left, or in some cases left to right, players who like to work the ball will prefer D2 over D1. Again, we think they're both terrific products for better players, but if you prefer to work the ball, you will tend to prefer D2. And if you like to hit it straight, you will like D1.
Well, that makes sense, but I'm curious about the D2. Is this a tweaked or made over 905R, or it has a different shape to my sensibility? What's the benefit in going perhaps from a 905R to a D2?
Great question, and I would say that yes, the D2 is an evolution from 905R as opposed to D1, which is a fairly radical change from 905R. The evolution is in enhancing the MOI and making the golf club a little bit more forgiving while still retaining that same somewhat classic shape and the same workability and flexibility in shot shaping capability that we had with 905R. The primary differences are, you know, a slightly higher launch angle, a slightly lower spin rate, and an enhanced MOI, which makes the peak ball speed area slightly larger on 907 D2 versus R.
Given that, we've heard about and seen pictures, of course, of the D3 and the D4. Mm-hmm. The D4, I heard, was somewhat like the evolution of the 905S, which was the lower spinning back in the S&T days was the same size, but became the smaller companion to the 905R. And Titleist has always kind of employed the dual driver strategy. So will we see the D4, or is the 907 D2 kind of between the R and the S in terms of performance? So we'll just go with the D1 and the D2.
We feel like having two driver models is the best way for us to be able to optimize launch conditions for the various types of players we encounter. D1 and D2 do that very well, but with an emphasis on shot shape this time. D4 is a complement to D2, primarily just in size. It's a smaller version of D2. It's a 425cc version of D2. And if you can think about it, that smaller size means generally a smaller distance front to back. So PG isn't quite as deep with D4 as it is with D2, which means you get a little bit less dynamic loft, which means you get a little bit lower launch and a little bit lower spin. It's a product that we felt all along would be a niche that we might need for fitting some tour players with unique launch conditions. We don't think it has a lot of applications in the marketplace, and so more than likely it will stay as a tour-only prototype.
Well, I've got another question for you, going back to the 905 series. When that came out, it was an aluminum sleeve in the hosel that kind of drove home-based clubmakers crazy trying to swap out shafts. I take it the 907 does away with that sleeve?
Well, it doesn't do away with it, but it does address the issue because we heard the same thing. Guys who like to pull shafts and change shafts, it was a bit of an awkward spot with that sleeve in there because there was a possibility of the bond breaking between the sleeve and the head as well as the bond between the sleeve and the shaft. While not encountering any of those, we did address the issue to make it go away once and for all. There still is a sleeve, except now it is it's threaded as opposed to glued into the head. So we like the sleeve in there. It reinforces everything down in there that needs to be. Now there's no danger of it coming out, though, if you want to heat the shaft up and pull it.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, it is.
Titleist is not, of course, the first company to come out with a geometric driver. You're still catering, you kind of answered this before, but you're still catering to the middle to low handicapper. So do you kind of see the D1 is more of a better player's geometric driver, and the D2 is a traditional shotmaker's driver, while those other square drivers are more for the high handicappers that need all the help they can absolutely get?
Well, yes and no. I think we wanted to make a high MOI driver because there are some tremendous advantages to it. And primarily, you can create a very big peak ball speed area with maximum MOI. I mean, you can call that sweet spot if you want. But high MOI drivers can result in a very big sweet spot. We like that. We think they're both designed for better players. They both retain, while D1 has a triangular shape, it still is a pretty good-looking driver, certainly in profile position and the face angle and things like that that we know better players place a premium on. We basically just believe that in terms of any high MOI driver, however, that a triangle is a better way to make one than a square. We just think it's a more efficient shape. We think it results in us being able to have more discretionary weight to put where we want. We don't use up so much weight trying to make those two back corners of the square, if you will. And generally, it results in a little bit more weight being available for us to put where we want it while still obtaining very high MOIs and largely a more appealing shape, in our opinion.
I'm curious about the sales dynamic between the two models, the D1 and the D2. I've heard from some retailers that, you know, the square drivers that we've seen, very high MOI drivers, are bringing people into the store to demo them, but they're experiencing a distance loss. They're maybe not as long as the more conventionally shaped drivers. In your early sales outlook with these new 907 drivers, what's been your experience?
Well, it was a very interesting challenge to start trying to forecast what the resulting sales mix of D1 and D2 would be, because largely we've marketed ourselves toward the better player, who in general is a type of player who likes a traditional look in their golf clubs. Here we come with this high MOI triangular shaped D1 that, while exciting to some, we thought might be a little bit too much of a departure from the norm for others, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So we tried to get an early feel for what the sales breakdown between the two models would be, and in the end, I guess you could say we chickened out and opted for a 50-50 mix. The results have been, fortunately, very close to 50-50. We felt all along that D2 would be very appealing to Titleist loyalists. Mm-hmm. It's a very good-looking driver. It is, as I said before, a bit of an evolutionary improvement from previous versions, and those who like the look and feel and sound of Titleist drivers can very quickly and easily go into a D2. However, with the MOI buzz that exists in the marketplace today, we also felt like there would be some that got very excited about the performance benefits that D1 delivers. And that's been the case. I think as we go along, that D2 will be very popular among the traditional Titleist players, and D1 will perhaps attract players who are a little bit more adventurous in the look and feel and sound of their golf clubs.
How important is it to you that Titleist offers a wide variety of stock shafts, while other companies like Cleveland, of course, and TaylorMade kind of are pushing co-branded or, you know, even unbranded kind of shafts, while Titleist, you know, you offer 6 or 8 or 10 or kind of stock shafts that you can order from a green grass shop?
It's extremely important for a very simple reason. We believe that we make very good golf clubs, but the key to extracting every bit of performance value from them lies in picking the right one and getting properly fit for your unique launch condition. We feel like the best way to provide the flexibility and the maximum opportunity, if you will, for players to hone in on exactly the right driver to play, that we need to offer the various shafts that are available in the market. Most of those are designed to appeal to specific types of players or generate a certain type of launch condition. And the successful ones are successful for a reason, and that is that they deliver on those design premises. So we generally try to do a very comprehensive survey of what shafts are being played and are preferred by better players, and feel a sense of obligation to that player group to make those available.
Well, that's interesting, and that sort of brings me to another question about PGA Tour players and equipment. There's, you know, a lot of people see the tour vans, and they see the clubs coming out of the tour vans, and they think the guys on the PGA Tour are playing a whole different kind of club. Is that true?
You know, I chuckle at this one because I get it from time to time. Our motto is Titleist, serious clubs for serious golfers. We take that very seriously, if you will. And so we believe that the players who are playing our products have a pretty good skill level, and we design them all for players with that skill level, and there's absolutely no difference between the clubs that are used to make the tour players' products and those that are used to make the products that we sell through our authorized account. It's the exact same product.
Great to hear.
How important is the feedback you get from tour players when you're testing a new driver prior to its launch and in development, in the development and eventual release and marketing of a club?
Very. They are a literal part of the process. You know, we also have to be careful that there's a distinct difference between a club that's going to fit and work best for a tour player and one that is going to fit and work best for the average 5, 6, or 7 handicapper, who's a very good player in his or her own right. We're not looking to design a club for the tour player and then expect that exact club to work equally as well for everyone in our player pool. No, we do stop short of that. But their feedback is invaluable in that, you know, they have a keen eye for what looks good, for what sounds good. We also do have to be able to hone in on the right performance attributes for them in particular. And then we tend to, once it passes their litmus test, if you will, we then go about making sure that the entire line works well for our entire target audience.
Last question here, what's the best way for someone to go and get fit? Because fitting is certainly a very important aspect of any golf club. What's the best way for someone to go get fit for a 907 D1 or D2?
Well, we've got a national network of fitters that we work with through our FittingWorks program. It's very easy to find one. We have a website dedicated to all things fitting. It's called FittingWorks.com. It's a fantastic resource for those who want to just learn more about what the fitting process entails, why they should get fit for equipment, and how they can go about finding one. It's a very sophisticated fitter finder in there, if you will, that it's very easy to use and very easy and very complete in letting consumers know what tools each of our fitters have to offer and the various parts of our product line that they can fit them to. So it's a great resource. I encourage everyone to use it.
Okay, again, that's fittingworks.com. We'd like to thank Steve Pelasek, the Vice President of Titleist Golf Club Sales and Marketing, for joining us today. And stay tuned. We'll be right back.
I'm working on shortening my swing.
Holding up more trophies.
Making the next Ryder Cup team.
Posting more low numbers.
Making everything I look at.
Getting the club more in line at the top.
Drawing the ball.
Working on my pivot.
Being more consistent.
More wins.
More wins.
More wins.
More wins.
More majors.
Just trying to get better.
Working on beating this guy.
Working on a whole lot of things.
Even the world's best want to be better. That's why there's the new Pro V1 and Pro V1X.
And welcome back. This week in Beating Balls, just a couple quick segments here because the podcast is probably long enough for you guys. First off, Tiger Woods has chosen his course designer. Jack, tell us a bit about Bo Whaling.
Well, you know, he's from the Fazio School, which some will quarrel about. I mean, Fazio to me is one of my favorite designers. I've played a lot of his courses and I find them very interesting and, you know, very strategic. But a lot of people find them, you know, kind of quirky. And
I think it'll fit in well in Dubai for the first course, though, so kind of a Mickey Mouse-ish place to build a golf course anyway. So
exactly. You know, give me a desert and I'll give you a golf course. So the jury is out. But, you know, this is Tiger cashing in on his name. It has nothing to do with his ability as a designer or a affectionate of golf course design. And he's, you know, it's business.
Okay. Jeff, tell us about this first two Tiger Woods funny stories here then, too. Tell us about the first one with Henrik Stenson.
Well, Henrik Stenson smashed his driver. He had an errant tee shot, and his driver exploded and glanced off a cameraman's hand and head. So the next morning, Tiger comes onto the practice tee with a hard hat on and says, "I'm ready to play with you now." And so they both busted up laughing. So, which is a good joke.
It's a side of Tiger we don't often see, so I thought it was kind of funny. I like to pass it on regardless of who would make that joke, because it's kind of funny. The next one here is Rory Sabatini made some comments this week about Tiger Woods being more beatable than ever, and saying something like along the lines of, "I like the new Tiger, he's more beatable than ever." This being the same Tiger that at that point had won 9 of the previous 12 PGA Tour events and 3 of his 6 this year. Tiger responds by saying, "If I remember the quote correctly, he said he likes the new Tiger. I figure I've won 9 of 12, and 3 times this year, the same amount he's won in his career. So, yeah, I like the new Tiger as well."
The joke was on Sabatini when he started flapping his lips.
At Sabatini, who I believe tied for the first round lead, ended up finishing one shot higher than Tiger Woods in the Players' Championship.
Exactly. Well, I think it says two things. I think, one, it says Sabatini's an idiot, and he keeps proving that over and over again. The other thing it proves is that Tiger is, I mean, he's perfectly right in saying that and it being funny, but at the same time, it's not the most gracious remark to make, you know what I mean? It's, you know,
it's tough to say because, you know, it's Rory Sabatini. I mean, this isn't PJ Singh saying it. You know, I mean, he might show some deference to a guy that's not an ass.
Well, maybe. Exactly. Or he could just be above it and say, next question.
Well, I think the onus is on Sabatini because, I mean, you know, you make statements like that and either you back it up or you keep your mouth closed. You know, that's two options there. Either you come ready to play and beat him or you keep your mouth closed. And quite frankly, he should have never said it in the first place because any good champion on this tour is just not going to say that kind of stuff.
That was dumb.
We might add about Sabatini that in the player poll he was ranked the, you know, the least favorite guy to play with. So that tells you a lot about Rory.
That's right. Ahead of Phil Mickelson by 15 or 18% or something. So a wide margin.
That's saying something.
Yeah. Well, another real quality guy here, Sergio Garcia, Mr. Spittoon himself, denies allegations of cheating at the TPC. I saw this, and they showed Sergio Garcia chipping with his, it looked like his back heel was over a drainage grate at the bottom of a swale. I had assumed that he was playing the ball as it lied and just chose not to drop, because to me it looked like his heel was on the drainage thing. Apparently he had actually taken relief, and to be honest, from where I was looking, it looked like his part of his heel was still touching the drainage grate. Under the letter of the rules, that's not taking complete relief.
I agree, and I think the caddy had it right. Again, Sergio and his all his beer commercials be darned. The caddy was right. He was still standing on the darn drainage grate, which were as big as basketballs at the TPC, which is a whole other subject.
We'll get into that. Cliff's caddy wanted to make a big deal, he said, but it wasn't. This is almost the same exact thing he said when he spit in the cup. He said, "Oh, it's not a big deal. I spit in the middle. It didn't touch the cup. That's it. It's not a big deal." It is a big deal. He says, "I'd rather shoot 85 than shoot 65 cheating." Like I said, from what I saw on TV, he was standing on the grate by, you know, I mean, it might have been a half an inch or an inch, but his heel looked like it was on the grate.
I agree. And that's not cheating. I mean, maybe it's not cheating, but certainly not following the rules. He's got it, you know. Right. Whole teenage charm thing is wearing thin, and we got to get over it.
Next to last thing here is the PGA Tour is considering a change to who makes the cuts, because if more than, you know, 78 players or so make the cut, because they keep the top 70 in ties, you run into problems with, do you split tee them? If you get even the slightest weather delay, you can't finish in time for television or before it gets dark. all kinds of problems. Do you think the cut should move to 60 in ties, or the nearest number to 70, or any of the other ones linked to in this article, Jeff?
That's a tough call for me. I mean, this has been, you know, the tradition of 70 in ties has been there for a long time, and I would have a tough time. I think that the network and the ability to broadcast these tournaments, that would really have to drive this. I mean, it would have to be a very important thing, I think, before we start tweaking with it, because obviously it's someone's paycheck, it's someone being there next year, but there'd have to be some pretty substantial reasons for me to agree with it.
Jack, what would you cut to if you were the czar?
What Jeff just said, I think, you know, there's a lot of guys who, there's money involved here, and there's guys whose living is involved, and I'm not sure cutting to the top 16 ties as Tiger's espoused is the right way to go.
I have a solution.
Okay.
Play faster.
Well, substantial, yeah, exactly. Substantial discipline would take care of this.
The players want to keep their top 70 ties, fine. Say, okay, guys, play faster. That's it. That's all you have to do. If we keep 84 guys around for the weekend because y'all tied for 70th, play faster. No problem.
Speaking of fast play, would somebody have paddled Sean O'Hare's backside to get him moving? Because that was pathetic.
Well, hopefully his father-in-law will. Last topic this week, the firm and fast players, TPC players, whatever it's called now, the course. Not so firm and fast, was it?
It was a joke. It was a joke. And I'm sorry, I've written on this site about this. And, you know, I may be wrong. I may be ragging on this too much. But that golf course is not a championship layout.
It was anything but firm and fast. This was the whole point of this multi-million dollar redo. And, you know, I expected balls to be bouncing and rolling off greens and through fairways and all kinds of stuff. And all I see is Phil Mickelson hitting a driver that stops within 4 yards of where it lands. And 5 irons sitting on the greens.
Well, the greens were so slow, the Tiger couldn't put them.
They were pretty slow. They said they were running at 12 and a half on the stint meter. They got a screwed up stint meter.
That was a lie.
That's the they're using the same yardstick they used to measure their you-know-whats again, right? Yeah, it's
there was no way those greens were 12 on the stint meter, and there was no way that they were firm and fast, the greens or the fairways. You could watch the drives hit the fairways, and you know, two bounces, and they come to a halt.
And they didn't get any rain, except a little bit on Wednesday, so it's bunk. I'm really trying to figure out what they spent all that money doing.
Yeah, well, unless it's a watering problem, and that may be they're going to have to, you know, look at this year's players and come back next year with
a
little
watering problem, because they said the course can drain a 2-inch thunderstorm in 2.5 hours. So,
well, they're,
you know, they got the sub-air system and all that. It can't be a watering problem. I just, you know, and then someone said it was new grass, and yet the reason the old course was slow was because it was old grass. Apparently they need to get AstroTurf.
There's a word for it, and it's boondoggle. They didn't have it where they wanted it.
We'll end it on that. That's episode 58 of the Golf Talk Podcast, the firm and fast edition. For firm and fast, this is Eric Barteski saying hasta la vista.
Talk to you next time.
Hey, goodbye from Soprano Land.